This is how we do it.
Do it. Do it. Fake ass little bitch.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client.
Mama Monster.
Conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Fat delete.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 512 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, September 10th, 2017. I am the Solid Monster. Right off the bat, I want to say thank you to everybody who picked up a Sound Off shirt during our Labor Day sale last weekend. The sale itself netted about $100, and I matched that, and we donated, it was $100 to the Houston Food Bank, with the other $100 going to the Houston SPCA, to help with Hurricane, I already forgot the name of the last hurricane. We're dealing with a completely different hurricane, or actually the people down south anyway, are dealing with a completely different storm now. Harvey, that's what it was. Man, that tells you something right there, that I had to think about what the name of that hurricane was. But Hurricane Harvey relief in the Texas area. So those are the two charities that the money went to, $200 total. I posted the receipts up on Facebook for those who might want to see those. So again, thank you. Those of you in the path of Hurricane Irma, which is the one I was thinking of, I hope you got the hell out of there, and I hope that you're all safe. It's already wiped out an entire Caribbean island. I know it pounded Puerto Rico, and we have some listeners down there. It made landfall last night and hit the Florida Keys this morning as a Category 4 storm, which is pretty devastating stuff. Now we have, I see Jose behind it, and there's already early models showing a direct hit on New York City. In about 10 days or so. I know it's too early to predict what's going to happen with these things. But it just feels like it never ends. So please, everybody, stay safe. And this too shall pass. I don't know what else to say. It's scary. It's very, very scary stuff. But best wishes to everybody who's dealing with this down there. I just can't imagine what that's like. I mean, I remember what Hurricane Sandy was like when it hit New York, and I, you know, that was nothing compared to what the people down south are going through right now. So again, hopefully everybody is safe and sound right now. I want to thank Audible for being a great partner here to the show. The link is always audibletrial.com/solomonster if you want to not only support the podcast but take advantage of the 30-day trial, so you can sample the Audible service and get yourself one free audiobook of your choosing. Tons of wrestling books up there, if that's your thing. Tons of non-wrestling books, if that's your thing. One thing to keep in mind, though, you can use our Audible link to pre-order for free the new Ric Flair and Charlotte book. I think it's an autobiography. There's a new book about the Flair family. It's about, I think, Ric and Charlotte in particular. And it's called Second Nature, The Legacy of Ric Flair and the Rise of Charlotte by Brian Shields. Brian's a good dude. Brian also worked on that really nice History of WrestleMania book for WWE a couple of years back. So that book is available right now for pre-order on audible.com. And you can, I believe, use the Solid Monster Audible link to pre-order and get the book for free. So again, audibletrial.com/solomonster. The book drops on September 19th, so I believe that's next week. So if you want to take advantage of that, please do so. And if you'd like to support the show with a PayPal donation, as you guys well know, you can do so on thesolomonster.com. PayPal button's on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. We got a lot of support this week. I want to say thank you to Yvonne Bruiser Balak. Thank you very much. Steven Handyman Halistick, Lee Hired Gun, Hieronics, Chuck Lunatic Lentz. You guys are all lunatics. Thank you. John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Out of Control Cody Thomas, The Florida Freebird, Bryant Becerra, Luis Hercules Hernandez, left hook Luke Hyams, Dream Chaser Chauncey Curry, Mass Grave Micah Harshaw, Aim for the Head Andrew Jorlog, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Max the Axe Velado, Pistol Patrick Krauthamel, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, the Scottish Assassin Colin Kayer, Jonathan Killjoy Keen, Davis the Empire Enos, the Woodside Wildman Stephen Demain, the Last Outlaw Andrew Gelinas, or Gelinas, I think it's Gelinas, but in any event, Andrew, you are awesome. Thank you very much. Unfiltered Philip Kendall, Tony Payday Packham, Airstrike Clinton Wright, the DC Slayer Marcus Cross, the Wilmington Warlord Tyler Williams, and a gift from God, Garrett Mills, a first-time donator. Thank you for becoming one of our PayPal VIPs in our little family here. Too bad. Trajan Willingham, thank you very much for the first-time donation. And last but certainly not least, Alex Sticks Cardozo Solis, also a first-time donator and long-time listener. So the support this week was very strong. I appreciate that. Thank you to everybody in the Facebook group who helped out in the thread that I posted a few days ago. I really appreciate it. Mama Monster, I know she appreciates it too. She is going through a, we'll just say she's going through a very rough time right now. We all are. It's very, very difficult. But just know that all the kind words really do mean a lot. And thank you for the suggestions as well. Before I get into all the news of the week, I saw a very interesting poll that I'm sure many of you saw as well. There's a poll from the Washington Post, University of Massachusetts Lowell, the joint poll, of the percentage of professional sports fans and sort of how they're divided up and the different sports that are most popular down to least popular in this poll here. The question that was asked was, do you consider yourself to be a fan of, and then you sort of insert each sport, or not? This is the percentage of adults who responded yes. And it was a poll that was conducted a few weeks ago. It was a national poll, random sample of 1,000 adults. 1,000 adults, which is a pretty good sample size if anybody's ever conducted a poll before. That's why I'm always, you know, impressed by the response that I get to the Twitter polls that we do. You know, you're not talking 50 people or even 500 people. You know, when I do like a Raw or SmackDown poll, it's easily 2,000, 2,500 votes for big pay-per-views. We can get as many as 4,500 or 5,000 votes. So in this case, it was a random sample of 1,000 people nationally. And I don't think this is really a surprise that the most popular with 60% was pro football. So, you know, the NFL, obviously the NFL season just started and football. Although, you know, football ratings have been on the decline. I know this first game with the Patriots where they got, you know, they got their butts kicked. That did not such an impressive TV rating. I think it was down, I forgot the exact percentage. It was down from last year. Last year was down from the year before that. So there is an issue that the NFL is dealing with in terms of declining TV ratings. But the NFL is still by far probably the most popular, not even probably, it is the most popular sport here in this country. I would say baseball is number two. This poll bears that result out. Baseball came in at 45%. College football tied baseball. College football tied pro baseball with 45%, which I guess is a little surprising. I know college football is a big deal, March Madness and all that kind of stuff. Or is March Madness the college basketball? I don't even know. I don't know. Now people are gonna castrate me for that, but I don't care. I don't care about any of that stuff, honestly. But I'm fascinated that college football would tie with pro baseball. Anyway, basketball came in at 39%. College basketball came in at 35%. Pro boxing, 28%. Then we had mixed martial arts, so we're talking UFC and Bellator and all that. That came in with 25%. Pro soccer, which, it's been a slow ascent here in the U.S., I think, in terms of the popularity of soccer. It's definitely more popular now than it was 5 years ago, but only 24%. Auto racing came in also at 24%. Ice hockey, came in at 22%, way down at the bottom of the list. Pro wrestling, such as WWE, it says. 14%. 14% of people. And I think there should be a little asterisk there because it really should be 14% of people admitted to being a WWE fan. I do still think you've got a lot of people out there who do watch, maybe not every single show, but they do watch, and there is still that element of shame that's involved, I think, for some casual fans who don't want to admit that they're fans of pro wrestling. I don't know how much of a difference it would make in the number. Maybe it's the difference between 14% and 17%. I don't think it's the difference between 14% and 30% or 40% or anything like that. But it was way down in dead last here on this list. And they've done other polls like this in the past, and wrestling consistently ranks at the bottom of the pile. I guess you could argue, is it a sport, right? Is it a legitimate sport? I mean, I look at it as a sport. I mean, it's a combination of sport and entertainment. But, you see 60% for pro football and 45% for baseball, and then wrestling is way down there at 14%. And I know that's not the sort of thing that WWE likes to see, because they always come out with these statistics about our social media following is higher than all these sports leagues combined, which is all well and good, but when you look at the amount of money that these sports leagues are generating, what WWE does very much pales by comparison. So, yeah, wrestling is, I guess the moral of the story here is pro wrestling really isn't as popular right now as some people might think, or WWE might think it is, which is really not that surprising. I would be very curious, though. You know, as hot as wrestling was when you had the two warring factions in the late 90s, I honestly still think that even then wrestling would have ranked, maybe not dead last, but I do think it would have been near the bottom. I do think that you have a lot of people out there who will sneak a peek, or they enjoy watching Raw, they enjoy, or whatever. They're certainly aware of who the key players are, like John Cena, and they've heard of him, they've heard of probably, you know, Roman Reigns and maybe a few other people, The Undertaker. And a lot of them also are probably lapsed fans who just stopped watching every single week. They gave up on the product, you know, years ago. But I do still think that they would consider themselves fans, but maybe they wouldn't admit to it, but not a good showing here for pro wrestling here in this poll. This was a newsworthy week for Global Force Wrestling. GFW announced that Jeff Jarrett is taking an indefinite leave of absence for quote-unquote personal reasons. Jeff Jarrett, already out of power, hasn't even been a year. And he got it. He kind of got his company back in a way, right? Now, all of a sudden, he's on the outs again. He is still staying on as a consultant. They are framing this as a mutual, not a parting, but they are framing this as a mutual sort of situation here, which is weird. He obviously didn't see it coming because the same day, the very morning that this announcement was made, he was tweeting about the month of September and how excited he was for things that Impact had planned, and actually he used the tags on Twitter for Impact Wrestling and for GFW Wrestling. Even he sounds confused about what the hell to call this company. I say from now on we just call it Total Nonstop Global Force Impact. There you go. That way we cover all of our bases. But he seemed to be excited about what was coming up, and then you got the hammer dropped, and then there was radio silence for a couple of days there. Anyway, this might help explain Rebbie Hardy's threats. If you remember, Rebbie, of course, has no love lost for Jeff Jarrett. And multiple times she has alluded to drunk texts that Jeff Jarrett sent her, or sent her and Matt Hardy many months ago. I don't know that she's ever released them, although she has released snippets of stuff here and there. But perhaps that has something to do with what these personal reasons are. We don't know. Karen Jarrett tweeted out her thanks to Ed Nordholm and Anthem for giving her husband the time that he needs. And in all seriousness, you know, if Jarrett has a problem, you know, I hope he gets whatever help he needs and gets it all sorted out. I actually am going to defend Jarrett on one thing here. I'm not the biggest Jeff Jarrett fan in the world. But I have to say this, you know, there was a story in this week's Observer. Apparently, Jarrett did not look good at the Triple Mania show a couple of weekends ago. Okay, that was said at the time. And I actually wanted to see what he looked like. Because he came out, I think, for a battle royal. There was talk that he was stumbling down the stairs. I didn't really see him stumbling down the stairs. I mean, they looked like steep steps. But he didn't look good. Just, you know, physically did not look good. So I saw that with my own eyes. But apparently at that Triple Mania show, and again, the leave of absence, his appearance and his performance at Triple Mania may well have been the final straw that led to this really what sounds like a suspension to me. They're calling it a leave of absence. Call it whatever you want to. It sounds like a suspension to me. But anyway, the Observer story noted that after the Sexy Star incident, when Sexy Star went and wrenched back on Rosemary's arm and legitimately injured her, even though Sexy Star doesn't believe that to be the case, Jarrett was understandably very upset because Rosemary is one of his people, and they took advantage and hurt one of his people. He was very upset about this, and he went to Sexy Star and told her in no uncertain terms that she needed to apologize to Rosemary for what she had done. And she clearly was not willing to do that, at least now, maybe, you know, begrudgingly later on. I think when Vampiro got involved, she may have said, "I'm sorry," but certainly in the subsequent statements that she has made, I've not really seen her say, "I'm sorry" for anything that she did. But her husband, now her husband is a boxer. In fact, I think he's a champion boxer down there in Mexico. This guy, Johnny Gonzalez, apparently he stepped in at that point. And he may have, you know, gotten up in Jarrett's face. He was defending his wife, felt that she was being threatened or unfairly maligned or what have you. And Jarrett, to his credit, and I will give him credit for this, he apparently got up in the guy's face. Now, this guy is a champion boxer. I don't know that he's a big man. I've not seen photos of him. I've only read that... I've read certain things about this guy, so maybe he's not a physically imposing person. I certainly would not want to, get in the face of somebody who punches people in the face for a living and is pretty good at it. But Jarrett got in the guy's face and supposedly said, "I don't give a shit who you are. Your wife was out of line and she needs to apologize." Good for him. Props to Jarrett for sticking up for Rosemary, if that's true. I will give him credit for that. One good thing, though, that comes from Jeff Jarrett not being involved here with GFW, at least for the foreseeable future. And I do think at some point he'll be back, because he's always back. I mean, all these people, Dixie and Jarrett, they're like mosquitoes. You know, you can try to swat them away, but inevitably they're going to fly back. So he'll be back at some point. But one of the good things about Jarrett being out of the picture for now, PW Insider had mentioned that the scheduled main event for this year's Bound for Glory, which is their big show of the year. Okay, this was before all of this happened. What was penciled in, apparently, what the plan was Jeff Jarrett in the Bound for Glory main event against Alberto El Patron, which sounds terrible for a Bound for Glory pay-per-view main event. Neither one of those guys should be in the main event of what is supposed to be the biggest show of the year. That sounds like a terrible idea. Actually, bringing Alberto back at all sounds like a terrible idea, let alone putting him in the ring one-on-one against Jeff Jarrett. So apparently that will no longer happen. We're not even sure when Alberto is going to be back. He's claiming it'll be very soon. Apparently he's got something like 6 months or so left on his contract, so he'll be back. But he's still, on suspension himself. The other big story, because it wasn't just, you know, the Jeff Jarrett bomb sort of dropped, and then it was either later that day or the next day that the other big bomb dropped. And it was a report from Justin Barrasso over at Sports Illustrated, who claimed that Anthem, the parent company here, they run the whole deal. Anthem is supposedly, according to this report, ready to pull out of the wrestling business altogether and sell GFW. He claims that Anthem even had to gut the Fight Network, which they own, in order to finance GFW, which is true. I think there were layoffs. And probably other cuts as well, but I believe there were layoffs at the Fight Network some time ago. And so I read this report and I just think to myself, here we go again, right? Around and around we go. How many times have we read similar stories about shakeups with TNA, then Impact, now GFW, or as I said earlier, Total Nonstop Global Force Impact? But it's like every year it's the same story. You know, we have reports of a possible sale and then it doesn't happen, but then of course, you know, stuff does happen and Dixie is out of the picture and we do have new owners. But, you know, we've also heard rumors in the past that there was a done deal, right, for WWE to swoop in and buy the tape library, and that never happened. So This is just a report. This is an unverified report. Obviously, the company is denying this, which I would expect them to do. Just because they're denying it doesn't mean it's false. I mean, look who we're dealing with here. But GFW reps have adamantly denied there's truth to any of this. Kevin Sullivan, no, not that Kevin Sullivan, but Kevin Sullivan, the one that works for GFW, went on Twitter and attacked Sports Illustrated for the report, called it bad journalism, fake news, whatever. They also put out a press release. They were very quick after all this bad news broke to put out a press release with a bunch of announcements to try to get the message back on point. Let's make things positive again. So they put this press release out, and because they were just getting slammed with all this negative publicity. And it mentions that GFW has re-upped with Pop TV for another year to keep Impact on the network, which they had already announced a few weeks ago. I mean, I'm a PR person. I work on press release. That's part of what I do for a living. And it's kind of weird that you would, there would be news or an announcement weeks ago, and then you'd put another press release out 2-3 weeks later announcing the same thing. But they were just trying to change the narrative as quickly as they could and shove as much good news as possible into this press release. So they announced that, again, they re-upped with Pop TV for another year. And that's all well and good, except that the company apparently makes peanuts on that deal. They don't make any real money off that TV deal like they did when they were on Spike. So it's nice that they have a home. It's nice that they will at least be able to air their show for another year, but they're not really getting paid. They also announced plans for their own streaming service, very similar to the WWE Network, using content from the TNA library and the GFW libraries. They are not selling to WWE. Ed Nordholm did an interview and made that very clear that at this point they are not selling to WWE. He has a sense of how much money they can make if they were to sell it to WWE, and he figures, well, why do that when we can keep it and monetize the thing ourselves? That's what he said. So that's what they are doing. They also announced plans to launch their own Impact Wrestling channel on Pluto TV. Yes, Impact finally got a TV deal on Pluto. So congratulations to them on that. That's kind of where things stand with GFW. You know, we had this report that came out that made all these claims. The company is adamant that it's not true. And I think the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle. I do think, you know, the key takeaway from the Sports Illustrated thing is that Anthem is hemorrhaging funds. They are hemorrhaging money, keeping GFW afloat, running the operation. I don't doubt that they're losing a lot of money. I don't see how they can be making money right now, running GFW. Where's the money coming from? It's not coming from TV. It's not coming from all these live events. They did a few live events recently that didn't do so hot. I don't think they have any more scheduled. I don't know if that was just a failed experiment. I don't know if they're just going to run live events every 3 months or 6 months. So they're not making money off those. You know, what are they? Are they bringing in so much money on merchandise? They're not even running that many pay-per-views. One pay-per-view per year, maybe two. So where is this money coming from? You got to pay Alberto, you got to pay all these different people. I don't doubt that they are losing money. Hemorrhaging? You know, that's a strong word, I don't know. But like I said, I think the truth is somewhere in the middle here. I don't think things are as rosy as they paint them out to be, but I also don't necessarily think that they're going to pull out of the wrestling business in the next couple of months and sell the company. I think a year from now, we're still going to be sitting here talking about Anthem trying to pull out of GFW or running GFW. I don't think really much is going to change. And, you know, it's good that they'll continue to exist, but how do you grow? How do you get bigger? I don't know, because I don't see a path. You know, they're going to launch this streaming service, and it sounds cool, especially if you're like an old school TNA fan. You want to get your hands on all those old X Division matches and shows from the mid-2000s. Yeah, that's cool. How much money are they going to make off of this thing? You know, is that alone really going to make a difference for them? We'll find out. But, you know, I don't doubt right now that they're struggling, and I don't see a pathway for them to suddenly, you know, grow and start making all this money and turn into a really profitable, successful, you know, operation. I just think the story of TNA or TNA... or what did I call it before? Total Nonstop Global Force Impact. I think the story is that they just continue to sort of exist. And they just, you know, every now and then it's one step forward and then two steps back, and it's like the hamster on the wheel. I mean, that really is the perfect analogy for, you know, somebody ought to just like do some sort of like Photoshop or GIF or something of like the GFW logo on a hamster wheel, just sort of, you know, pedaling in place, because that's been the story of this company now for so long. And I know, I don't doubt there's a lot of people out there who want to see them do well. You got these idiots out there who yell at people like me for saying, you just want people, you've said you want people to lose their jobs. It's like, fuck off. You know, you morons out there say stuff like that. When have I ever said that? You know what I mean? Like, I've never, ever said that. I don't have a fondness for some of the people who run that operation over the years. I think there's a lot of boneheaded decisions that have been made. I think there's a lot of really stupid, boneheaded things that they've done and people that they've brought in and all that stuff. But I've never, you know, said that I want to see people lose their jobs. You know, EC3 is going to be out of a job or, you know, people like that. They have a lot of talented people on that roster. How frustrating must it be for them to constantly read stories like this? People like James Storm, who, except for that one time he dropped by NXT to say hello for a couple of matches, he's been with TNA pretty much from the start. You know, he's one of the originals. What must someone like him think when he's sitting at the airport browsing his phone, browsing Twitter, and he sees stories like this from Sports Illustrated, when he sees stories like this from other places that the company is hemorrhaging money and they're looking to sell and this and that, and he sees these photos of these you know, minor league baseball stadiums with 20 people in them? It's got to be demoralizing, or to perform in front of crowds like that, it's got to be demoralizing. And you'll still have fans who just have their head in the clouds because they're so far up TNA's ass that they just can't see things for how they really are. There's a reason why people like AJ Styles are no longer there. There's a reason why people like Samoa Joe and Bobby Roode are no longer there. You know, hey, respect to people like James Storm who have stuck it out. A lot of those guys haven't. They've moved on. There's a reason for that. So where this is going to lead, I don't know, but I do think that a year from now we'll probably be sitting here in the same exact situation. I don't see Anthem, you know, pulling out anytime soon and abandoning ship. Maybe they want to, but I don't see that happening. But I also just don't see where this growth is going to come from. Speaking of Impact, congrats to former Impact member Christy Hemme, who announced this week that she is pregnant with quadruplets. She's got four little horsemen inside of her. Or horse women, I guess. We don't know yet. I interviewed Christy this year when I did the Fight TV stuff at WrestleCon. I had a few minutes with her, and she was to interview her. And she was as nice as can be. So I know, I think she even mentioned in her video that, you know, when you've got four babies inside of you, that's obviously a very high-risk pregnancy. So fingers crossed, hopefully everything goes well. But she was bubbling over with excitement in this video. I can't even imagine what the husband must be thinking. My God. I mean, just imagine, like, let's say you and your wife are trying to get pregnant. You find out, okay, she finally happened, right? You're going to have a baby. You're going to bring a baby into this world. And then the doctor turns around and says, well, wait a minute now. There's a little caveat here. You're bringing more than one baby in. And then you think to yourself, oh my God, I'm having twins. This is great. And then the doctor says, well, not exactly. You find out you've got, what, three? Nope, keep going. Four babies at once. I would run away. I would change my name and run away. I can't even imagine what that must feel like. But she's very happy, and I'm very happy for her. Let's talk about Raw. Let's break into Raw, the show from Omaha last Monday. I've got some thoughts on this show. Actually, before we even get into the show from Omaha, WWE made an announcement this week that for the first time ever, Raw will be presented live on Christmas Day and New Year's Day consecutively. So back-to-back Mondays, they will be live on the USA Network, as they are every single week. Now, Raw has aired live on New Year's before, as many of you also pointed out to me. The last time, I believe, was the show where K-Fed, remember him, Kevin Federline, he pinned John Cena. K-Fed remains undefeated against Cena, by the way. But whatever year that was, I think it might have been 2007, I think. That show did air live. Actually, Noah mentioned to me. He mentioned that, I think it was in Miami. So that has happened before. But the show has never aired live on Christmas Day. The years where they have aired first-run shows before hasn't always been a case where it's been a recap show or a year-in-review type show, especially like in the early 2000s. I mean, there were shows where it was a first-run program, but that does not mean that the show aired live that night. All those shows were taped days in advance, so those shows did not air live. In fact, you would have to go all the way back to the year 1986, 31 years, to find the last live show that WWE held on Christmas Day. That's how far back you'd have to go. As you can imagine, this has caused quite the uproar. Nearly every single comment under the WWE announcement when it was made was negative to the idea. People very upset about the wrestlers not being able to spend Christmas with their families. Both Matt Hardy's wife and Jeff Hardy's wife have been very vocal about this on their Twitter accounts. Rebby saying that Christmas has been ruined with a picture of the Grinch. And Beth Hardy, who's Jeff's wife, did say that she heard, I don't know if this is just covering and trying to protect WWE or not, but she heard that this was a USA Network idea, not a WWE idea, which actually makes sense. I mean, it probably was a USA Network idea. The third hour of Raw was also a USA Network idea that WWE just went along with in case they weren't already enough of a villain in this scenario. We know exactly who the heel and who the... I mean, is WWE really the babyface? It's like two heels, basically. But USA... You know, when I found out that it was a USA call to add that third hour of Raw, USA became instantly the biggest villain in all of wrestling to me. I do think, you know, me personally, I think it is pretty crappy. These guys work 52 weeks a year on the road, right? Or 51. Usually they get that week off. They usually get at least that week off. That is literally, I think, the only week that they usually get off the entire year. Now they won't even get that. And, you know, people can talk about the NBA all they want to. Well, you know, the NBA has a game on Christmas Day every single year. Yes, they play on Christmas Day every single year. They're also not in season 12 months out of the year either. Now, it is true, you know, if you go back to the territory days, days of the NWA and all that, you go back to the late 80s, Thanksgiving and even the early 80s, Thanksgiving and Christmas were some of the biggest shows of the year, where they did some of their biggest business. Look at Starrcade. Starrcade was a Thanksgiving Day tradition until WWE created the Survivor Series and gave them a middle finger and forced them to move it to Christmas. But there's a reason they did shows on those days, because they actually did really well. People came, you know, people, families, they came out to the shows. I don't want to say that they built their entire year around those holidays, but clearly those were some of the biggest days of the year in terms of business for a lot of those promotions. I know Jerry Lawler, who wrestled lots and lots of shows during that era when he was arguably at his peak. On his podcast, he said that he would never wrestle on Christmas. He never did. He never would. He said it's almost sacrilegious to him. That's what he said. And he's been around for a while. So this is not like some kind of new thing. Oh, everyone who's making a big deal about it, all the millennials, all the newbies, they don't remember how it used to be. Lawler's been in the business for probably at least 40 years. And even he said, you know, working on Christmas, he just can't imagine doing it. Honestly, I think using that argument that, hey, you know, wrestling used to do really well on Thanksgiving, and wrestling used to do really well on Christmas, I think it's a dated argument. That doesn't really apply today, because the business is so different now. You know, especially when it comes to TV. I mean, my God, look how much of it that there is. Do you really think that the live attendance that night, I don't even know what city they're in, but wherever it is for the Christmas show, I think the New Year's show actually might be back in Miami. But I think one of them might be in Chicago. Maybe the Christmas show is in Chicago. Do you really think that the live attendance that night is going to be appreciably different than it would be any other week? Really? Of course not. Now, if it is a USA idea, they don't care about live attendance. What does USA care about live attendance? They don't give a shit about that. They care about ratings. They care about ad dollars. So, will the rating be any higher than it would be for a taped show? I don't think enough to really make any difference at all. If they would tape the show on December 22nd and air it on December 25th, if there's any ratings difference at all, let's be honest here, it's going to be minuscule. If they tape a really stacked show, like they promoted hard in advance, 2 weeks in advance, we're going to have two championship matches and a gimmick match, it's going to be a big, big show. But they tape it 3-4 days in advance, and the spoilers do get out and people can read the results, but even still, I doubt the show being live is going to really make much of a difference in this case. Which is why I think the wrestlers and their wives and their families have a right to be upset. If you could show them that, hey, look, we're doing this. Here's why we're doing this. This is going to be a bigger paycheck for you, right? Your take-home pay is going to be this much higher if we work these two shows. Even then, I'm not saying that their families would be very thrilled about them being away and on the road for the holidays, but at least then you could justify it and say, well, look, I mean, look at this. Look at the dollars here. You know what I mean? But nothing they can do about it. If it was going to make that much of a difference in business, like I said, I would understand it. But this isn't Starrcade in 1983. This isn't Survivor Series in 1987. But the network is their master. That is the master that they serve. They're paying them a lot of money. And WWE knows that they have this contract renewal that's up in the next couple of years. So best not bite the hand that feeds you, I guess. It's shitty, but that's just the way it is. So Raw, from last Monday, let me bring up the poll results here. We had 2,000 votes in the poll, 65% thumbs up, 35% thumbs down, so another good rating for Raw. This John Cena-Jason Jordan match, I thought that was the best thing that they've done with Jason Jordan since they started all this Kurt Angle, you know, Kurt Angle's son nonsense. I mean, people were still mostly flat for him when he came out, but they did react to that double Northern Lights suplex spot, which I thought was really cool. Even in defeat, and let's be honest, the outcome of this match was never in doubt. If anything, I'm surprised that there were people online who were upset about this. You know, John Cena is wrestling Roman Reigns in 2 weeks. Do you really think that he was going to lose to Jason Jordan? Are there people out there who honestly believed that John Cena would lose and should lose to Jason Jordan 2 weeks before this match with Roman Reigns? Are you out of your mind? He should not be losing to Jason Jordan. And if you don't like that, then they shouldn't have done the match. I actually liked it. I thought it was a fresh match. When I saw that it was announced, I kind of joked, oh, look, you know, Kurt Angle obviously doesn't care about his son, you know, tongue in cheek. But I was kind of intrigued because, you know what, it's a match we've not seen before. It's not like they announced, well, it's going to be John Cena against The Miz. It's going to be John Cena against Curtis Axel. It's like, who gives a shit? John Cena against Jason Jordan, it made me go, huh, okay, well, let's see what the kid's got. This is his biggest match of his career up to this point. And I thought he did very well for himself. You know, they also aired footage before the match. They were trying to tell this story that John Cena, when he made his debut on SmackDown about 15 years ago, it was against Kurt Angle. Remember? Ruthless Aggression, and they had a match. And they actually showed highlights. And I guess the idea is that it's kind of like a full circle deal where Cena came out to wrestle Kurt. Now, Cena's the veteran, and he's wrestling Kurt's son. Whatever. Point is, you would never know from watching those highlights, but Kurt Angle won that match. And yet, they certainly didn't want you to know that John Cena had lost the match. Point is, though, you know, here, that was a star-making moment for Cena. Now, I don't think people are going to remember this match 15 years from now. Honestly, they probably won't remember it 15 days from now. But Jordan losing here is fine. I thought Jason Jordan gave John Cena a tougher match than Baron Corbin did at SummerSlam. And Corbin won Money in the Bank this year. So I thought this was fine. I had no problem with Jordan losing. If you would have gone in there and gotten squashed, you know, Roman came out and kind of made fun of him. You know, it took you 20 minutes to beat a rookie. That was part of his promo. But I thought Jordan did very well. And hey, if John Cena puts a good word in for him, the guy's got it made. If he didn't, it's the kiss of death. But I didn't see any reason. I didn't see anything in that match that, you know, would lead me to think that John Cena had any reason to be upset. I thought it was a good match. Now, Roman Reigns came out after the match, tried to redeem himself after their first face-off the week before. And I thought he did very well. I thought he did much better than the week prior. Dare I say, we got to see heel Roman Reigns here, because he came off as a total dick here in this promo. He even polled the audience at one point. He says, "Hey, Omaha, you want to see John Cena kick my ass?" And they all cheered. You would think, you know, John Cena also gets the half reactions, but everybody in the building cheered. They hate Roman Reigns so much that they're actually willing to cheer and get behind John Cena. Now, that's heel heat right there. When you can find somebody who's that hated that they get somebody like John Cena universally cheered on a chant like that, that's impressive. I don't care what anybody says. So the two of them traded dick and ball jokes. John Cena finally threatened to beat some sense into Roman Reigns, and Roman smiled. I hope that like TV tracks, if he puts this up, I hope he can find the screen cap of that face that Roman made here. It was the cheesiest, meme-worthy troll smile I've ever seen him make. And then he says, "Do it. Go ahead. Beat my ass." He called Cena's bluff, and Cena did nothing, which led to Roman calling him all talk and saying, "That's why I don't respect you." And he dropped the mic and he walked off. I thought it was great. Simple, to the point. He seemed more comfortable out there. I'm sure it helped that he didn't, you know, forget his lines. But I thought he came off so dickish here, and it just worked. I mean, to me, there's no doubt going into this match who the heel is and who the babyface is. I don't know why Vince McMahon doesn't see this. I don't know why he insists on making this guy the top babyface when he is so easily hated. You know, you can't blame it on the smart cities either, right? Oh, it's Brooklyn. Oh, it's Chicago. Oh, it's LA. This is Omaha, Nebraska. And they booed the hell out of this guy. Embrace the hate. They did on this show, at least. After he beat Cena, I'm telling you, full speed ahead, do the Shield reunion in time for Survivor Series. Have a match and have him turn on Rollins and Ambrose. Mega heat. Are you kidding me? If I was in the building that night and he did that, I would want to jump the barricade and go after him for ruining the big Shield reunion. That's the way to do it. John Cena came out 2 weeks ago and he said he's in the no F's left to give phase of his career, right? Isn't that what he said? Roman needs to tattoo the letters, you know, IDGAF somewhere on his gear and just run with it. Right, I don't know that Mattel would like that very much. I wouldn't expect that to be tattooed on any Roman Reigns action figures anytime soon. But the guy's already out there, you know, calling Cena a fake-ass bitch. So, hey, you know, really, how much worse would it be if he did tattoo that? If they put that on his vest or something like that, you know? Austin used to walk to the ring with the BMF vest. So you can give Roman the I don't give a fuck vest and just let him come out. And I'd like to see more of this, Roman Reigns, honestly. Nia Jax and Emma beat Sasha Banks and Alexa Bliss, meaning that the Women's Championship match at No Mercy is now a fatal four-way match, including Nia and Emma. Nia had the match won for her team. Emma tagged in. I think it was a blind tag. She stole the pin on Sasha. Nia, you know, I gotta say, Nia may be slowly winning me over. And one of the reasons is this tweet that she sent to Emma during the week. We'll call this the Savage Tweet of the Week. So Emma tweets at Nia, you know, all part of the story, saying, "You should be thanking me for getting you a match that you don't deserve." And Nia's response was just 5 stars. She quote tweets Emma, and she responds to her and says, "Did you thank Vince for the 6-month vignette push that you had but never capitalized on? How much more do you deserve?" Oh my God. Nia showing no mercy here for Emma. Well, to be fair, Emma did set herself up for that one. I mean, there's a lot of ammunition that Emma has that you can use against her, and Nia did not hesitate to do that. By the way, while we're on the subject of tweets, I may as well do this now. There is a sad tweet of the week. That was the Savage Tweet of the Week. There is a sad tweet of the week, and it goes to Liv Morgan from NXT. We haven't seen too much of her on TV lately, and I don't know how much of her, honestly, we're going to see with this whole influx of talent that they're probably going to have from the Mae Young Classic. There's just so much good female talent, and I'm going to talk a lot about this later when I get into the Mae Young Classic stuff, but I believe that she's been dating Enzo Amore. I think that's been pretty common knowledge anyway, that she was dating Enzo Amore for a while. Well, it looks like no more. She posted a tweet last night, very cryptic, that said, "Me knowing that I'm single and nobody is cheating on me." And she included a gif of herself smiling. Enzo Amore is a certified schmuck and a bona fide bonehead. I thought this guy was out of his mind when I saw that he paid 10 grand for a ticket to the Mayweather-McGregor fight. Now I'm convinced that this guy has lost his mind. Big Show and Braun Strowman were in the main event on this show. They had a steel cage match. Now again, these guys have had a couple of matches on TV already this year, one in which they collapsed the ring. They have a good chemistry together, right? I'm trying to think of the last like giant match, like the last big man match like this that we've had that consistently has delivered. You know, you don't really hear the same complaints about, oh, they're boring, oh, they're plotting, oh, they can't wrestle, oh, they're slow. Big Show and Braun, man, they work well together. And this was no different. This match was sort of just made out of nowhere. I assumed it was just because they were trying to, you know, with the cage gimmick, they wanted to do something to kind of boost the audience for Labor Day because they knew the audience was going to be down for the holiday. But also what it served to do is really, you know, going into this championship match in No Mercy with Brock Lesnar, it just makes Braun look that much more like a beast. So they went in there, they had a competitive match. It was a great big man match. Big Show did an elbow drop off the top rope. He had the benefit of holding onto the cage. I have not seen Big Show deliver an elbow like this since the Survivor Series in Madison Square Garden. Remember when he was against Mark Henry? I will never forget. I was in the building that night. I see him climbing to the top. Everybody rises to their feet. They're waiting. They can't believe that. What's he going to do? Right? Maybe he's going to do a shooting star. We don't know. And he's perched up on the top rope. Mark Henry is laying there. And he's perched. And he's waiting. And he's waiting. And he's waiting. And we're all thinking, is he frozen in fear? Is he having second thought? And I think even on commentary, when I went back and watched him, somebody was like, is he having second thought? He was up there for so long. And finally, he jumped off with the big elbow and everybody cheered and they started a Randy Savage chant and it was this great moment. So we don't get to see him doing that very often, but he did here. He's probably, look, I mean, the guy's nearing the end of his career. It's now or never for big moments like this, right? You may as well just let it all hang out. So he delivered a pretty impressive elbow drop. He got some pretty good hang time for a guy his size coming off the top. I don't think the elbow actually connected with Braun, but doesn't matter. Strowman gave him a superplex off the top rope later in the match, which did not collapse the ring because we were told numerous times that the ring had been reinforced. They never really explain what that means. I guess that means more springs under the ring. I don't know. But they reinforced the ring, which is why it didn't collapse. The reason it didn't collapse is because people would die, okay, if the ring collapses and then the cage implodes. Although I will say that would be a pretty cool visual. But anyway, he hits the suplex off the top, hits his power slam. He was able to hoist up Big Show, gave him the power slam, pinned him. Braun gets an impressive win going into the pay-per-view. He goes to leave. He stops. He has second thoughts. He comes back. He grabs Big Show and he says to him, "Time to go out to pasture, old man." And he picks him back up over his shoulder and he throws him through the cage, one of the side panels on the cage, which I actually is exactly what I thought they might do. If you remember, I think I said that on last week's show. So he puts him through the cage. Big Show landed very safely. He landed, you know, pretty much right on the mesh, but he was selling a hip injury. Reason being, he is going away for a while. I think he actually is having minor hip surgery, so maybe that's what they're going to sell the injury as. But it was a great visual. It served its purpose. Braun is a beast, and Brock has a lot to worry about going into No Mercy. This would be a fitting end if this was the end of Big Show's career, and I don't believe for a second, not for one second, that it is. But if it was, it would be kind of a fitting end, because if you remember the Big Show, how did he debut in WWE? He debuted coming up through the ring in the middle of a steel cage match. He picked up Steve Austin and he threw him through the side panel of the cage. So if Big Show had his career ended by somebody who threw him through the cage, I think it would be quite appropriate. But I don't believe for a second that that's the last we've seen of Big Show. I think he'll be off TV for a while. He'll heal up. He'll come back. I figure that guy, he probably, let's be honest, I mean, he's got another couple of years probably before he hangs it up. It's tough for these guys to step away. I mean, you got to think Big Show's making good money. He's probably making great money, right? I'm not even sure. Is he even working full-time? I can't imagine his schedule is what it was 5 years ago. He's got to be making great money. Why give that up, right? I mean, if he's feeling pretty good, I mean, I know he's getting older, but, you know, there's no reason for him to hang it up right now. Why would he? SmackDown. SmackDown was live from Sioux Falls, South Dakota Kai. Twitter poll, over 1,700 votes. 74% thumbs up, 26% thumbs down. Corey Graves has replaced JBL on commentary, which is like trading in a Ford Pinto for a Ferrari. And for all the people who wanted to see Renee Young, and I floated that as a possibility because people had started a petition to get Renee Young in the spot and get a female voice in the booth. For all the talk of that, Renee actually went on Twitter. She thanked everybody. She was flattered. But even she admitted, she said, "I wasn't very good the first time that I did commentary." And truth be told, she wasn't. So good on her for acknowledging that. But I think Corey Graves is a fine choice. You can make the argument, you know, he's already on Raw. Now he's going to be on SmackDown. Why not get somebody fresh in there? You get somebody fresh in there if you have somebody who can actually do the job and do well at it. And, you know, looking at who they had, now they did take Nigel McGuinness. He's going to continue to do NXT, but now I guess Nigel is going to be part of the 205 Live team. I would not have minded seeing Nigel McGuinness in that spot on SmackDown with Saxton and with Tom Phillips. So you could argue that that should have gone to Nigel, but I can't hate on putting Corey Graves in there because Corey Graves is maybe the best they got. He's really great in that role. He's the closest thing that we're going to get in this era anyway to a Jesse Ventura type of color guy. So, some people were saying, well, it also kills the whole idea of the brand split. The brand split, it is what it is. You know what I mean? Like, there's always going to be mixing. It's all the same. They don't go out of their way to really try to make it feel like a separate entity because everybody knows it isn't. So, you know, what do you... You're going to make hay about the announcers being the same? If all of a sudden... I mean, look, John Cena became a free agent. What a convoluted explanation for that, by the way. John Cena goes from SmackDown. The next week, he's on Raw. Are we really going to bitch about the fact that Corey Graves is on two shows and how it kills the brand split? WWE can, you know, do that five other ways. I don't mind Corey being on this show. I think it's fine. But this show was built around Kevin Owens and Shane McMahon. They had an in-ring segment together where Owens blamed Shane for screwing him and brought up the helicopter crash, as he called it, that Shane had a month or two ago. You know, some people yelled at me at the time for calling it a crash landing. They're like, no, it was an emergency landing. There was no crash. Well, they're calling it a crash landing, so that's what I'm calling it. Owens said that Shane's family, his wife and his kids, would have been better off if he never survived the crash. Which, forget how tasteless that line is. Doesn't even make sense. It's like they stuck that line in there just to be edgy and to give Shane a reason to go off on Owens for mentioning his kids. And I'm like, really? The guy's family would be better off with him being dead? That doesn't even make sense. And I'm thinking like, why not, if you're going to go down the tasteless road and just kind of go all in on that, then why not say something like, you know, with how much you seem to like screwing people, I'm surprised you don't have more than three kids. Right? Now that would have been a cool line. That would have given Shane a reason to go after this guy and kick his ass. Or something like that. You know, it's not like he named his kids. He mentioned the fact that he had kids and then he said that stupid line. I just thought it sounded forced. And something like that would have made more sense, but again, it's one line in a promo. Anyway, Shane lost his cool. He went after him. They tumbled over the announce desk. I bet Corey Graves wishes that he was back up on stage like they are on Raw. This all resulted in Owens telling Daniel Bryan he was going to sue the entire McMahon family and press criminal charges against Shane. I bet you that does not happen. It'll probably be forgotten about by next week. Bryan called out Shane to the ring later in the show and told him, look, I got a call from your father, and per the chairman of the board, I'm sorry, dude, I hate to do this, but you are hereby indefinitely suspended. And he later told, Daniel Bryan did, later told Kevin Owens that Vince McMahon himself will be on SmackDown this Tuesday. I have to assume it's to announce a match at Hell in a Cell, in the Cell, between Shane and Owens. It's the only thing that makes sense. You know, Shane is no longer commissioner. He's no longer an executive, which means he's free to wrestle. And so I would think that the match announcement will come on SmackDown this Tuesday. James Ellsworth almost cost Carmella her Money in the Bank briefcase here on this show in the middle of her match with Natty. Ellsworth was up on the apron. He accidentally dropped the briefcase into the ring, which the referee took that to mean, oh, he's cashing in. The guy already won the briefcase for her the first time, right? Now he's cashing in for her. It's like this woman can't do anything on her own. And she sees this and she starts to freak out. She's like, no, I'm not cashing in. And then Natty rolls her up for the win. So she got the distraction roll up and picked up the victory. After the match, Carmella said Ellsworth wasn't even human. She called him a genetic defect and said that his mother should have given him away at birth. Wow. You know, between this and the Owens line about Shane's family being better off if he died in that helicopter crash, they sure went out of their way to try to shock people on this show. It felt that way. After I heard that line, I'm like, okay, somebody, I don't know who it was on that staff, but somebody was trying to be edgy, a little too edgy here on this show. She then fired him. Okay, so let's put this in perspective here. She says all these horrible things about James Ellsworth. This guy almost cost her her Money in the Bank contract. She embarrasses him. She scolds him. She fires him. Basically fires him in front of the world. So naturally, later in the same show, what did she do when Ellsworth begged for forgiveness backstage? This same man who earlier she said wasn't even human? Called him a genetic defect? She laid a wet one on him. Does that mean that Carmella is into bestiality? I don't know. I hope not. Then after she kissed him, she slapped him. The only semi-logical explanation I could come up with for this is that she realizes that she still needs him. She needs to keep him around, like a dog. But doesn't want to, like, let him get too full of himself. Again, I may be trying to apply logic to an illogical situation here. We had the reincarnation of Dolph Ziggler. Or maybe you can call it the rise and fall and sort of rise and fall again of Dolph Ziggler. That'll be the name of the DVD when it comes out. I thought this segment was horrendous. I thought this was awful. He comes out, he gets on the mic, he says, all the fans, all you want to see are dumb gimmicks. And he proceeds then to parade around in various dumb gimmicks. They play John Cena's music and he came out pretending to be Cena. Then he left and he came back dressed as a low-rent version of the Macho Man. Then he left and came back out dressed as Naomi doing her glow gimmick, her glow entrance. Then he said that he doesn't care what the fans thought. You make me sick. And then he left. And that was that. I was going to say, you know, I'm surprised he didn't come out dressed up as Shawn Michaels. But he already does that every week. I doubt anybody would have noticed the difference. They had Aiden English pin Sami Zayn in a one-minute match. Sami chased him to the back after the match. I so hope that they keep beating Sami Zayn like this, like every single week. Beat him in 30 seconds, beat him in 60 seconds, beat him over and over again until it backfires on them. And the fans start giving him the Daniel Bryan treatment and interrupting the shows. And then, months later, after they finally relent and they push him back up the card, they can take credit for it and say, see, it was our plan all along. AJ Styles met Ty Dillinger in the back after Dillinger lost to Baron Corbin. Styles was very upset that it took a cheap shot by Corbin to beat Dillinger. He thought that was very unfair. And so he said, next week, I'm going to open up the U.S. title open challenge to one person. And that person is Ty Dillinger. And so it'll be nice, I think, for the two of them to have a match longer than, what was the one they had? About 60 seconds last week, I think. It'll be nice to see them have a longer match this time. You know, I heard an interview that Chris Jericho did this past week. He's got a new book out. So he's going around doing interviews, and he did an interview with the on the Observer site. And he talked about what the original idea was when he came back on that one SmackDown show a couple of months ago, originally, he was only coming to the building that night to film some stuff for the second season of Southpaw Regional Wrestling. You know, he's Clint Bobski on there. He was going to come in and film his shit and then leave. But he figured, well, I should probably let Vince know that I'm going to be there, because Vince doesn't have anything to do with any of the Southpaw stuff, and Vince probably had no idea he was even going to be in town. So he's like, hey, let me tell Vince. So he tells Vince, and of course, as soon as he tells Vince, Vince wants him to work the show. So then at Battleground, the finish got screwed up in the Owens-AJ match, and the title changed hands when it wasn't supposed to, or it was a last-minute call in mid-match by Vince. Depends what story you believe, but in any event, things got screwed up. And so it turned into a three-way match on that SmackDown when Jericho came back. It was AJ, Jericho, and Owens, and Jericho took the fall, and AJ won the title back. But the original idea was for AJ to issue the open challenge and for Jericho to come out as a surprise and for the two of them to have like a 2-segment long match, I assume, you know, with AJ winning in the end. I'm kind of pissed it didn't happen that way, to be honest with you. I mean, how cool would that have been, right? That would have been a legitimate surprise for this open challenge gimmick. I thought they would do that with Shelton Benjamin a few weeks ago when we first were hearing rumblings that he was coming back and he was going to be on SmackDown. And I said, well, you've got the perfect way to introduce him now, because he can be a surprise for the open challenge, and, you know, he won't win, but he can go out there and probably have a pretty kick-ass match his first night in with AJ Styles and establish himself as you know, like a mid-level guy on that show. And they opted to go in a different direction and pair him off with Chad Gable, which they still could have done. But I was kind of hoping they would do that, and they didn't. I have to say, you know, so far the open challenge stuff has been a real letdown. You know, when John Cena did it, I really enjoyed it. It turned into a fun gimmick, which is why I don't mind them recycling it again with AJ. And AJ could go out there and have a great match with almost anyone. But so far, it's I mean, I think the first like 3 or 4 weeks of this gimmick, it was Kevin Owens coming out every week. And then it was Baron Corbin, and he was fighting over it with Ty Dillinger. And it's like, let's get some like real people out here, you know? But the Dillinger match should be good. I'm looking forward to that. Shinsuke Nakamura in the main event pinned Randy Orton with a Kinshasa, which now gives him clean TV wins over Orton and John Cena within the last month or so. I mean, if that isn't a sign that they're all in on this guy, I don't know what is. I really don't know what else they can do other than put the title on him, which I think they will. But, you know, clean wins on TV over two of the biggest stars in the company within a month, that's a pretty big endorsement right there. There was a really cool counter in this match, a counter of the RKO into an armbar. I like this match more than the Cena match that Nakamura had. And Nakamura now gets his rematch with Jinder Mahal, I assume at Hell in a Cell. I still say you do the title change on that show, get that belt off of Jinder, and then build to a title match with AJ Styles, with AJ going over at next year's WrestleMania.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
WWE made it official this week, announcing the signing of Donovan Dijak, who left Ring of Honor in February. The article on WWE.com said, in 2015, he won Ring of Honor's Top Prospect Tournament, and earlier this year, he competed in the WXW 16-karat gold tournament in Germany. He's also wrestled for Evolve, and this past weekend, he fought in Pro Wrestling Guerrilla's Battle of Los Angeles tournament, held in Reseda, California. Yeah, apparently he and Keith Lee had this amazing match of the year candidate together on that show, which, if that's true, I haven't seen the match, but if that's the case, not a bad last match to have before coming to the Fed, right? Do people still call it that? The Fed? Probably not since they changed the name, I guess, but they call it New York. He's coming to New York. After 523 days, Asuka is no longer the NXT Women's Champion. This is my sad face. You can't see it right now because this is audio only, but I am very sad. So ends one of the all-time great title runs in the history of that entire company. We don't get to see title reigns that long anymore. We had CM Punk holding the WWE title for 434 days, and that's about it. It's just, you're not going to have reigns like Bruno had. You're not going to have reigns like Hogan had and people like that back in the day. Or even John Cena, right? John Cena, was it like 2007, probably? The only reason that run even ended was because he got hurt. I think that was when he tore his pec. So it doesn't happen very often. And Asuka is an interesting case in that Asuka, I would argue that she is at least as popular and probably more popular now than she was when she first came in. And she came in with a lot of hype and a lot of buzz around her from the people, you know, the hardcore fans that, you know, fill up Full Sail and that knew of her from Japan. And they've done a tremendous job. You know, Triple H and his team deserve a lot of credit for doing a tremendous job of protecting her and making her feel special. And, you know, she's not on the show every single week. And her matches, her entrances, everything, it feels like a big deal. And that's 2 years after she debuted. That's a rare thing. And I think that, again, it's a fundamental difference between the main roster and NXT. A lot of these guys on the main roster, when they get called up or if they come straight over, and maybe AJ is the exception, AJ Styles, but a lot of those guys come in, they feel special, they have a lot of fanfare, and then within a matter of months, they don't feel so special anymore. And the bloom is off the rose and the buzz is gone. It's hard to maintain that. It does eventually fade for everybody, but they've managed to keep Asuka feeling really special and hyped for 2 years now. I hope it continues at least a little bit into her run on the main roster. I'm not totally optimistic about that. I do at least hope they keep her undefeated. I hope they realize what they have in that streak. But it was a pretty impressive run that she went on here. William Regal invited her out to the ring to close out the show this week. They made the announcement that they have entered into negotiations with the general managers of Raw and SmackDown, Kurt Angle and Daniel Bryan, to bring her to either show. They didn't specify when. They didn't, I guess, because they're negotiating, and that'll give her time to heal up, I guess, from her injury. But she got lots of chance here. She got a great ovation from the crowd at Full Sail. I think they knew. They had to know that this was probably her last appearance there. She said soon the main roster would find out that nobody is ready for Asuka. And the entire locker room emptied out onto the stage to give her a round of applause. I saw Kairi Sane in there. Maybe the closest that we come to the two of them being in the same arena, at least for a few years anyway. Ember Moon busted through the group. She walked down to the ring. They had a brief stare down. Ember extended her hand, and when Asuka went in to shake, Ember pulled it away. But then they hugged. Then Triple H came out with his signature bouquet of flowers, and he and Asuka hugged. At no point did they make mention of the broken collarbone, but you could tell here, like at the end, she was being careful not to lift the right arm. I think it was the right arm. Being careful not to lift it too high. At the end, she put her left arm up. Now she can take the next several weeks, like I said, to heal up from the injury, which I do think there are still people who don't think it's a legitimate injury. I believe it is a legitimate injury. It's not overly serious. Again, she probably would have been okay to go for the next TakeOver show, but they opted to move her up, which is their prerogative, right, as Bobby Brown might say. So that's what she's going to do. She has time to heal up while they, quote-unquote, negotiate. Probably going to Raw. That's the scuttlebutt, anyway. They have something special with that undefeated streak. I would not beat her anytime soon. If they beat her, let me say this. If they beat her within her first few months on the main roster, Vince McMahon should have his promoter's license pulled. That is promoter malpractice if they break that unbeaten streak in the first few months of her being on that main roster. Also on this show, Lars Sullivan manhandled three guys in a handicap match. No Way Jose danced to the ring to attack him and got... So he did this as retribution, right? Because Lars Sullivan laid him out on TV a few weeks ago. And so Jose comes out and he gets laid out again. What a goof. They aired a taped promo with Sanity on the show. They were calling out Adam Cole, Bobby Fish, and Kyle O'Reilly. They shot this differently. You should watch this. I actually like the way that they shot this. I thought that was very unique. They showed footage of Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch working out together at the Performance Center in one of the rings with two random guys. So indeed, it looks like they are putting them together as a tag team, which I think is awesome. That's exactly what I mentioned a few weeks ago. I was hoping they were going to do. It seemed like that was the direction they were going in. Regal's out there. He's observing them from ringside. I think somebody mentioned that the people next to him were the promoters for Progress, were actually just standing there next to Regal. And so up walks Ruby Riott. She did her best Lars Sullivan impersonation and asked for a handicap match against Billy Kay and Peyton Royce, and Regal said, well, I can't do that. But if you find yourself a tag team partner, I'll be happy to make that match. And so she'll go out and pick a tag team partner. I would guess Ruby will pick Ember Moon, but I don't know. Main event on this show is Cassius Ohno in a no-disqualification match against Hideo Itami. This was fun. I enjoyed this. Itami went for the go-to-sleep, but Ohno escaped. Gave him the rolling elbow, but unfortunately for him, it knocked Itami right out of the ring. He rolled out to the floor. Ohno went after him. They ended up fighting up the ramp, and Ohno got suplexed on the ramp, which looked like it sucked. Threw him back inside. So Itami used a delayed drop kick in the corner. Kicked a steel chair right into Ono's face. He goes to kick Ohno in the nutsack again, which is one of his new signature moves, it seems. That's what he did in their last match on NXT. Kicked him right in the balls. But this time, Ohno had him scouted. He caught the leg. And then Itami poked him in the eye, which made me... I laughed out loud when he did that. I don't know if it was the way he did it. It was one of those like old Roddy Piper eye pokes. I laughed out loud when he did that. Then he picked up Ohno for the GTS. Ohno again slipped out, and this time he gave Itami a low blow. And Hideo's facial expression here was comical. Comical. I posted a screen cap on my Twitter. Ohno then hit the rolling elbow and got the pin. Really good match to end the feud. I assume to end the feud. But I was really struck by Itami in this match. I thought he was very entertaining. I think that he is he's finding his role here finally after all this time. And if he could stay healthy, and that's the key. I saw at one of the live events, I guess, against Aleister Black the other day, Itami got busted open. Half his face was like covered in blood. This fucking guy, he can't catch a break. It's like in one match he breaks his nose. In this match, half his face is covered in blood. This guy just can't catch a break. So I stress the words, if he can stay healthy, because you just don't know with this guy. But if he can, I think this is a good role for him to be in. They also announced, finally, at long last, a United Kingdom Championship match is going to take place this Wednesday on NXT. And better yet, it's going to be Pete Dunne defending against Wolfgang. They know me so well. You should have seen the smile on my face when they announced this match. So I am very much looking forward to that. So those are the key points from NXT this week. Now, let's talk about the Mae Young Classic. I watched the second batch of four episodes that dropped on the network this past week. They were even better than the first four. Commentary really wasn't much better. I would say no better, no worse. There were a few times where JR called forearms Superman punches. Dakota Kai at one point hit a big boot that he called a Kinshasa-like knee. He confused an RKO for a stunner. Which, again, is not to say that I'm unhappy to hear him back announcing or to see him doing what he loves doing. I mean, God, the guy, look at the year the guy's had, for God's sakes. You know, it's actually really cool to see him back out there. But I got to be fair here, right? I mean, if I'm going to call out people like Michael Cole and Tom Phillips for fucking up and making mistakes, then JR should not be immune to that same criticism. And I think people hold him up to a certain standard as well. And so it's been noticeable when he has made those slip-ups. Lita is just sort of there. Doesn't really offer any insight. She's just, you know, a female body to have there. They could have picked another female for the role. I guess they just didn't have anybody who they wanted in that position. And so Lita it was, and she's just sort of there. It is what it is. Some observations from this batch of four episodes here. Rachel Evers. If you remember in the opening round, Rachel Evers had a terrible match with Marty Bell, which I really think, after seeing her match here, speaks volumes about why that match was so terrible, because Rachel Evers came back here in this round in the quarterfinals, had a much better match with Abby Laith. So that was very noticeable. Kairi Sane and Bianca Belair. I want to talk about this because these two stole the show on episode 5. I'll talk more about Bianca in a little bit. I've got more to say about her, but she is one of the more promising prospects that they've got down there. And I had only seen her a couple of times before this. There were a couple of random matches on NXT. Actually, one of which I think was a qualifying match for this tournament. And, you know, I knew the hair gimmick and everything, but there wasn't really anything overly special that stood out in those two matches about her. But there was a spot here in this match where she used the braid, that long braid in her hair, to whip the shit out of Kairi Sane, who isn't a big girl. I mean, she's a small, you know, she's tiny. And she just would not let up. I mean, she was whipping her like a dog to the point where even I was sitting there. And I'm sitting here like, hey, ref, you know, like, step in there. Come on, let's go do something here. What the hell? How is this not a disqualification? That thing is a lethal weapon. I said that on last week's show. I said it's interesting because she uses it as a weapon. That thing hurts. That thing is a lethal weapon. How do you, you know, JR made a comment. Actually, on commentary, he's like, how do you, I think the word he used was legislate. Like, how do you legislate something like this? We've never had somebody use their hair as a weapon before. But I'm watching, and the crowd got really animated. They were getting angry. If this were the 1980s in the Carolinas or something, people would have been jumping the barricade. You don't see that type of reaction very much anymore. Like, genuine heat. So anyway, I thought that was great. I actually had a similar reaction later on to the finish of the Shayna Baszler-Candice LeRae match when she wouldn't let go of the choke. What a mark I was, I guess, right? Watching this tournament now that I look back on it. But that's good, right? I mean, it's good that you're that invested in it, that you're actually reacting that way. It doesn't happen very often. So later in the match, Belair hit a 450. Off the top rope that got enough of a near fall that it had me convinced, just for a split second, had me convinced that she was going to win. She didn't. Kairi hit the elbow and pinned her. Actually, before she hit the elbow, she got her receipt on Bianca Belair with this spinning back fist. Holy shit. That was an Aja Kong-esque spinning back fist from Kairi Sane. And then it looked like she landed on her with her entire body and not just her elbow. So I love the back and forth here in this match. I thought the match was great. I enjoyed it. In the next episode, they had a match with Shayna Baszler and Mia Yim. It was not a very long match. Really, none of these matches were really all that long. But the idea here is that Baszler can lock in her submission, that rear naked choke out of nowhere, and the person has no choice but to tap. So Mia went for a 450. Baszler caught her on the way down, locked her in the rear naked choke for the submission. This was where we had our first horsewomen stare down at ringside after the match. Charlotte, Bayley, and Becky were there in the crowd opposite where Ronda Rousey and the other two were seated, and they all sort of stared at each other and were jaw jacking. They didn't like get physical or anything because they're obviously saving that for another time. Maybe in Vegas this Tuesday, right? You never know. Sasha wasn't there. For whatever reason, they had her doing PR in Australia at the time. Yeah, probably being stalked at the airport down there by some creepy kangaroo. Episode 7 is where Baszler wrestled Candice LeRae. They showed Candice's husband, who of course you know is Johnny Gargano, sitting at ringside. He was there for all of her earlier matches. Very supportive of his wife. This was very short. This was short even by the standards of most of the Shayna Baszler matches here in this tournament. But Candice, as soon as the bell rang, Candice went right after her. And she even locked in at one point the Gargano Escape, which is her husband's own finishing move. Okay? Or one of them anyway. And neither Jim Ross nor Lita even mentioned it. That's amazing to me. Especially with Jim Ross out there. How the hell did they miss that? The guy is sitting in the front row. He's actually there. He's sitting feet away from her. And his wife is using his move. And the crowd is reacting like she's going to tap out. It's like a big moment in the match. And no mention of the fact that it was Johnny Gargano's move. Candice went for the wild ride, which is her swinging neck breaker, off the middle rope. But in midair, Baszler reversed it. They both landed on their asses. And Baszler locked in the rear naked choke for the very quick submission. LeRae knew right away she stood no chance. She tapped out. I thought this was well done. Baszler, though, would not release the hold. They kept ringing the bell some more. They're furiously ringing the bell, and she just won't let go, doing her best sexy star impersonation here. Finally, she releases the hold. I thought maybe we were going to get like a SummerSlam 93 moment here where they'd reverse the decision for not releasing the hold like they did when Bret Hart refused to let go of the sharpshooter on Jerry Lawler, but they didn't do it. Gargano got in the ring to tend to his wife. Baszler almost got up in his face. She stared at him. He stared back at her. It was kind of a little tense moment there. I honestly, I'll say it right now. I think in a straight up fight, Baszler could probably take Johnny Gargano. So I think Johnny got off easy on that one. I think it would be, at the very least, it would be a lot more even, I think, than most people probably think. They had a match here also on the show with Tony Storm and Piper Niven. They had a real good match. I'm pretty sure Tony is already signed. If she's not, they need to sign her ASAP. But Piper also deserves to be signed. I mean, she had a very impressive showing in this tournament. I was not familiar with her. I had heard about Viper, I think was her name, in like ICW or something. And when they first announced the bracket of 32, there were some people saying, oh, you got to watch this Piper Niven. You got to watch her. You got to watch her. And I'm like, okay. And she was taking shit on the WWE Facebook page a few weeks ago for how she looks and everything. And that kind of bothered me. But I watched her here and she's really good. She's really, really good. Storm won with a leg drop off the top. Same with Kairi Sane in her match with Dakota Kai. Also a very good match. Dakota missed her running. It's kind of like a running haluva kick in the corner. Kairi hit the Alabama Slam, hit the elbow drop of doom off the top for the win. That led to episode 8, the final of the episodes from this batch. It only had two matches, Mercedes Martinez against Shayna Baszler and Kairi Sane against Toni Storm. Martinez and Baszler are stable mates from Shimmer, them and Nicole Savoy, who had already been bounced out of this tournament earlier on. I don't know if they have a faction name or anything. I tried to look it up real quick, but I didn't find anything. But I do know they've been a unit in Shimmer for a while. Lita finally made one good observation here in this tournament, which is that Baszler actually shook hands with Mercedes Martinez before this match, a show of respect for her friend. That was the one and only time in this entire tournament that Shayna actually shook hands with somebody, and I thought that was a good observation for her to make. Baszler's toughest and longest match here by far. She won with the Falcon Arrow into the rear naked choke for the submission. Triple H, Stephanie, Sara Del Rey, they all come out to present Shayna Baszler with a bouquet of flowers. This was the second of three times this week on TV that I saw him, Triple H, out there with a bouquet of flowers. It's like his new sledgehammer. He's mellowed out in his old age, and instead of hitting people with sledgehammers, he hands them flowers. Giving flowers to Shayna Baszler didn't really fit. She seems more like a, you know, like a Mortal Kombat fatality type of girl who'd probably rather like rip out her opponent's spine with her bare hands and hold it up for the world to see, right? Was that a Scorpion, right? It was either a Scorpion or Sub-Zero. I keep forgetting which one it was who did that. But in any event, came down to Kairi Sane and Toni Storm with the winner to meet Shayna Baszler in the live finals coming up on the network this week. The story was that Kairi suffered a concussion. Not the story of the match, but there was a story many, many weeks ago that Kairi had suffered a concussion sometime after they had taped all these episodes. And she's fine now, right? A few weeks after that, I think it was, it might have been Ryan Satin who put a report up and said she's been cleared now, she's fine. I don't know if she suffered the concussion here or if it was on one of those NXT live events that they may have her wrestling in down in Florida, but I'm going to say it was here. Okay, without knowing for sure, I'm going to say that it was here, because she came off the top rope with a high crossbody onto Toni Storm outside the ring and smacked her own face hard on that metal rammy. She took more punishment on that dive than Toni Storm did. She hit the side of her face on that ramp so hard that the entire side, first of all, you can see the imprint of the ramp on her face, but her face immediately started to bruise up, like within seconds. There is no way that she did not knock herself silly on that move, and that has to be where she suffered the concussion. She's lucky she didn't injure herself worse. So later on, Storm locked in a bridging armbar late in the match, was really cranking back hard on the arm. It looked almost like she was ripping Kairi's arm right out of her socket. She's gonna rip it right off. She was screaming bloody murder, but she would not give up. She won with the elbow in the end. Triple H, Stephanie, Sara Del Rey come back out. Triple H hit Kairi with his new finish, the flower power. Kairi hugged all three of them. They closed the show with her and Shayna having a stare down on stage next to the trophy that will be presented to the winner this Tuesday. I thought it was pretty genius how they use Shayna Baszler in this thing. having her run through all the fan favorites, Mia Yim and Candice LeRae. Who can hate on Candice LeRae, for God's sakes? Having her run through them the way she did, just, you know, got her even more heat. By the quarterfinals and the semifinals of this tournament, she was hated at Full Sail. There was no doubt where she stood with the audience. So now going into the finals, you have a clear heel and you have a clear babyface. There could not be two more polar opposites here in this tournament as far as Shayna Baszler and Kairi Sane. Kairi goes in there as the underdog against the tougher woman. It should make her win that much more satisfying in the end. I see some people saying that Baszler's going to win. She's going to win the whole thing because the whole thing is just the vehicle to kick off the horsewomen angle. First of all, I hope to hell that's not the reason why Shayna Baszler would win if she did win this thing, but I don't think she is. I disagree. I see it a different way. I do think she's in the finals in part to be on the show and to shoot whatever angle that they have planned to kick that thing off. I do think something will go down involving the horsewomen stuff on Tuesday, but that doesn't mean she has to win, right? There are other matches that they could have done in the finals that may have been a better match. But I think how they game this out was actually really smart, having these two, having it come down to them in the finals. And I do think Kairi is going to win. One thing I'm not sold on is doing the finals from Las Vegas and not from Full Sail, where the rest of the tournament was held. And doing it after SmackDown, like they do with 205 Live. You know, if they have 10,000 people in the building on Tuesday, and for a SmackDown show lately, that would be very optimistic. Okay, but if they do, I'm not sure half those people have even been keeping up with this tournament. So you have two women they may not even know going out there after the main show is already done. So I hope it all works out. I hope the people go nuts for it because a dead crowd can really hurt a show. And this entire show on Tuesday is being built around this one match. I assume they're going to add a match or two on the undercard with some of the other Mae Young Classic competitors, like maybe a six-man tag or something, but the whole thing is being built around the finals. It's this one match, and if you have a dead crowd, it could kill the whole thing. But I know why they're doing it. They want to make a big deal out of it. They're going to have a red carpet special. I think the red carpet thing airs on the network at 6 o'clock Eastern on Tuesday. They do the same thing for the Hall of Fame every year. And they're going to stream it on their Facebook page starting at 6. And they're hyping appearances by Ronda Rousey and Triple H and Stephanie McMahon and Charlotte and the Bella Twins and Hope Solo. Where the hell did she come from? But, you know, soccer star Hope Solo. Don't piss her off. she's one that you don't want to screw around with. But they're going to have cast members, apparently, from GLOW on Netflix are going to be there. I wonder if that'll include Awesome Kong. It'll be very interesting to see if, I think Kia Stevens is her name, if she's there on Tuesday. So the finals air live on the network at 10 p.m. after SmackDown Tuesday night. And actually, I'm just checking now. And as I am recording this, I am seeing that they have announced that there is going to be a six-person tag. There you go. That's going to be on that show on Tuesday. It's going to be Tessa Blanchard, Jazzy Gabbard, and Kaylee Ray against Santana Garrett, Sarah Logan, and Marty Bell. Huh. Anyway, that's going to be on the show along with the tournament finals on Tuesday, so that's the lineup. There you go. Looking back at this tournament, now that we're almost done with it, the real standouts, I made a list. So who stood out to me? Who impressed me? Who would I like to see more of? The real standouts from this tournament, who I think WWE should lock down if they haven't already, and I do know some of these women have already been signed. So like Kairi Sane, for example, she's locked and loaded. They've got her. I think they've got Toni Storm. So a bunch of these women have already been signed, as far as I know. But if they haven't been, they need to be. My list is Kairi Sane, right? Goes without saying. I think she's going to win the whole thing, so I would certainly hope she's under contract and they have plans for her. And I think that she'll probably be the one to fill the void left by Asuka, now that Asuka is gone from NXT. So, Kairi Sane, Shayna Baszler. I saw a lot of Shayna Baszler hate. Look, I mean, she's still relatively new to the wrestling business. It's not like she's got years and years and years of experience here. I think she'll get better. I think that the role that she plays I think is perfect. You know, that role, you know, the MMA fighter and the submission specialist and all that. That's the perfect role for her, and I thought she did well in the tournament. There was nothing about her that made me embarrassed for her or anything like that. And believe me, there were a couple of people who, you know, made me put my hand over my my eyes when I was watching them, but she was not one of them. I think that they should bring her in, and I think she may end up bypassing NXT altogether. If they do put together a horsewomen match, let's say, for Survivor Series, which is the rumor, she may leapfrog NXT and go right to the main roster. Dakota Kai, I have Toni Storm, obviously, on my list. Piper Niven, I think, deserves a contract as well. Abby Laith, who I believe they already have. Candice LeRae, we'd love to see them bring in Candice LeRae full-time. Sarah Logan, who is the former Crazy Mary Dobson, and I think also is already under contract. She belongs there. Mia Yim. I think Mia Yim, who looked a hell of a lot better than Marty Bell did, deserves a shot. Santana Garrett. I've said my piece on Santana Garrett. I couldn't understand why she wasn't already signed. For the record, somebody did fill me in on why she never signed previously, or WWE never extended an offer to her, which, if true, if what I was told was true, is a pretty crappy reason. Hopefully she gets her shot now after her performance here in this tournament. Mercedes Martinez. You know, Mercedes Martinez, they made it a point to mention she's 36. She's been wrestling for 17 years. She busted her ass to get to this point, and I think she proved here that she deserves a shot. I feel like for somebody like her, if she doesn't get signed now, then she's never getting signed. It's now or never. I mean, for her, it really is like a case of they either see the potential in her, they have a role for her, and they bring her aboard, or it's just not going to happen. So I would bring her in. Jazzy Gabbert, she got eliminated early in that first round, but she's got a presence about her. She really does. Apparently there was another match that she was in. It might have been a dark match, like a six-person tag, and the place went crazy for her then, too. I would definitely like to see them bring her in. Rachel Evers and Tessa Blanchard. We've seen the both of them come in for shots on NXT here and there, but I guess they weren't signed full-time. I think now they should be. Tessa had that great match, I thought, a very good match in the opening round with Kairi Sane. Rachel Evers is still very new, but is improving and had a pretty good match with Abby Laith. I think that both of them are, I think Rachel, I'm trying to think how old Rachel is. Rachel, I don't think is that old. Tessa might be late 20s. I think they both have a lot of potential, and I think they both deserve a shot. Now, there's two more names on my list here. Two women who maybe were the two that really opened my eyes and impressed me the most here in this tournament. Rhea Ripley. She's the 20-year-old Australian. I think she plays soccer. I think she might have been the former soccer player. She has a lot of potential. She's very young, but she looked pretty good here in this tournament. Great look. I want to see more of her. I should probably rephrase that, but you guys know what I mean. I hope. Bianca Belair is the other one, as I was talking about her earlier. Absolutely one of the best female prospects that they have. And if they don't already have her locked down, then they need to get on that ASAP. So that's half. That's half of the original bracket of 32. That's 16 women right there that I just named who I think belong under contract. They alone, just the women I just mentioned, they alone can make up an entire women's division. You talk about replenishing the well in NXT and that period that they went through after all those call-ups all those many months ago. And it was Asuka and everybody else. And it was like, man, they decimated this women's division. And they kind of built it back up a little bit, right? They had Ember Moon and Billy Kay and Billy Kay and Peyton Royce. They brought in Ruby Riott. They have Nikki Cross. So they did a pretty good job, I thought, of replenishing the ranks a little bit. But now you've got this wealth of female talent that could really, I think, sustain them for the next several years, just based on who I named here. Now, if I had to narrow it down to the three women who I think have the most potential to be a big deal, if not the star of the women's division in the future, you look at somebody like a Kairi Sane or a Toni Storm. You know, Kairi Sane, absolutely is going to be a big star. They may well build things around her, and they should, because she's that good. But I'm looking at people who are younger, who you can really like build a women's division around for years to come in the future. I pick three names, okay, and I'm going to rank them from number three down to number one, or up, I should say, to number one. If I rank them in order, I would put Rhea Ripley at number three. I can't stress enough. I see big things from her in the future. And she looked really good in this tournament for somebody who doesn't have a whole lot of experience doing this. Number two would be Toni Storm. She's only 21, so only a year older than Rhea Ripley. She's got more charisma than a lot of the men do on the main roster. So she's number two. And number one would be Bianca Belair. She's a little bit older. She's about 28, I think. But she's going to be a very big deal. The standing vertical suplex that we saw from her in that match with Kairi Sane, the hair whip thing, the 450 she busted out in that match with Kairi, she showed a lot in that match. I got to put her at number one. But you take those 16 that I just listed, who I think should be signed, and you add them to the women they already have in NXT, like Ember Moon, and Nikki Cross, and Ruby Riott, and Billy and Peyton, and Asuka hasn't even made her main roster debut yet. She's sort of in limbo right now, but you've got Asuka. Then you factor in the women on the main roster. Sasha, Charlotte, Bayley, Becky, Alexa Bliss, Nia Jax, Mickey James, Naomi, Natalya, Carmella, Emma, Paige is on her way back soon. I know the Bella Twins are talking about coming back together. That's easily the best collection and the biggest collection of women and women's talent in the history of the company. Easily. It's not even close. So that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. I have pretty high expectations for what they can do with these women after watching this tournament and seeing how many of them they have or should have going forward. They're in really good shape. So let's talk about Lucha Underground here, and then we will take some of your questions. The episode this week was Career Opportunities. Before I actually get into the episode, let me talk about Sexy Star here. Sexy Star was finally stripped of her AAA Women's Championship for what she did to Rosemary at Triple Mania. She also posted a lengthy statement on social media about what happened, in which she once again, talk about shooting yourself in the foot, once again reiterated that she does not believe that Rosemary was really injured because she was never given any medical reports or x-rays to prove that she was injured. I didn't know Sexy Star was a fucking doctor, too. Not only should she be blackballed from wrestling, she should be stripped of her medical license. She couldn't even refer to Rosemary by name. She kept calling her the North American woman. Over and over again. Reading this translation of what she said, and she said, the North American woman, the North American woman. In which case, you know what, going forward, I shall refer to Sexy Star as the Mexican moron. So the Mexican moron also whined about being cyberbullied on social media, including the letter written by the North American woman, she said. That counts as cyberbullying to her. Excuse me while I play the world's smallest violin. So thankfully, no Sexy Star on this week's episode. This was the 99th episode of Lucha Underground. We had Drago pinning the Mac in the opener to win one of the ancient Aztec medallions. Mac went to give Cobra Moon a stunner after the match for interfering, but Pindar and Vibora of the Reptile Tribe ganged up on Mac. Vibora was giving off some major Kane vibes here. I don't know if I was the only one to pick up on this. I mean, he's already got the size, we know that. And the long hair, but he's got the creepy mask. He hit a choke slam on Mac. Even the way he cocked his head to the side reminded me a lot of Classic Kane, which is a good thing, because Classic Kane was the best Kane. Reminded me of how much I miss having a masked monster on the roster. Right? We've got Braun. Braun is great. But I feel like we need a giant who also wears a scary mask. I'd say sign Vibra, but you guys are, when I mentioned that like a few weeks ago, you guys already pointed out to me that the last time I brought this up, you mentioned that he already was in WWE developmental. He was Judas Devlin, same guy who accused Bill DeMott of being abusive. So I'm not so sure he'll be invited back anytime soon, or if he would want to go back. Dario Cueto got in the ring and announced the main event for next week's 100th episode will be his brother, the Monster Matanza, against Rey Mysterio. There's also going to be an Atomicos match with Johnny Mundo captaining one team with partners from the Worldwide Underground. So it'll be Taya, PJ Black, and Ricky Mandel against Prince Puma, captaining his own team with partners that he himself was going to announce at the end of the show, but never did. We had a 5-0 street fight for one of the ancient Aztec medallions between Joey Ryan and Cortez Castro. They had an actual police cruiser parked ringside, cops in riot gear, or wrestlers masquerading as cops in riot gear, surrounding the ring. Matt Stryker put over the men and women in uniform on commentary and said they get a bum rap. This was a pretty crazy brawl that, yes, some of it was goofy, but you've got Joey Ryan involved. So you're going to always, you know, there's always going to be a certain level of goofiness when he's involved. My one main criticism was that, you know, when Castro did things like pour boiling hot coffee, right, down Joey's crotch, he used a taser right after that on his man parts. Ryan, he sold it for like 3 seconds and that was it. Then they moved on. After that, he was fine. I thought that was pretty stupid. That being said, I enjoyed the match. Reminded me of something we would see in the Attitude Era for the hardcore title. The cops basically served as lumberjacks. Their purpose was to kind of blockade Joey in there whenever he would try to run away. He used a pair of handcuffs at one point to bust open the top of Castro's head. He gave Castro a rock bottom on the hood of the police car later on. Castro poured hot coffee, as I said, down Joey Ryan's crotch. Then he maced him, and he slammed him onto a pile of riot shields and got the win. In a tune-up for his match with Rey Mysterio next week, Matanza beat three members of the Rabbit Tribe. All three members. They're the only members. Then Prince Puma came out to announce his partners for the Atomicos match coming up on the next episode when Johnny Mundo interrupted. He wanted to make their title match at Ultima Lucha more interesting, so he proposed that Puma put his mask on the line, which Puma agreed to do. He's like, all right, cool, we'll do it. Dario came out, he's like, well, we already have a mask match on the Ultima Lucha finale. That's the one with Phoenix and Marty the Moth. So instead, he proposed that Puma put his career on the line, which he also agreed to. And I take it that this will be Puma's swan song on this show. It may be everybody's swan song if they don't announce a season 4 soon. I'm starting to think it ain't going to happen. By the way, congrats to Melissa Santos. She announced this week that she and They Call Him Cage are expecting baby Cage next year. They call him baby. Or her, I suppose. I shouldn't say him. Marty the Moth will not be pleased at this news. But two pregnancy announcements this week. We have Melissa Santos here and Christy Hemme, although I think Christy has her beat. So, congrats to both ladies. Let's take some of your mailbag questions. We have an audio question, too. So we'll get to a whole bunch of them, and then we'll wrap things up here. If you have a question, the email address is always the same. It is thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from somewhere in the email when you write in. We do have an audio question. It does come from Ben in Melbourne, Australia.
Greetings, Solo Monster. Ben here from Melbourne, Australia. So after 8 episodes, we've arrived at the final of the Mae Young Classic coming up this week. And my question is simply, were we lied to by WWE? I can't help but feel that they were going on about it's 32 of the best women and this and that. And to be honest, some of them just didn't quite feel like it. Xia Li had never had a match before. That was her first match. Hang on, I thought it was 32 of the best women. We also had Kavita Devi from India, who, to be honest, she wasn't great in the ring. And Marty Bell, well, the less said the better, because as my mother taught me, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. So anyway, it's your podcast, not mine, so I'm going to stop talking. But did WWE deceive us a little bit? I do feel some of these women probably weren't up to scratch, even though there was some phenomenal talent.
I don't know if they deceived people. I mean, you know, when you build up a tournament, you build it up as, you know, 16 of the best, 32 of the best, 8 of the best. I mean, that's just kind of what you do. Yeah, I would think that there was more talent out there with more experience than some of these women had who would have been a better fit. But also, you know, as the tournament went on, in the quarterfinals and the semifinals, the matches got better because you were dealing in most cases with women who had a lot of experience going up against each other. In some cases, maybe they even worked together before, which always helps. And you have some women in this tournament. I mean, I mentioned Mercedes Martinez, for God's sake. She's got like 16 or 17 years of experience. So as the tournament went on, it got better and better. When you have the opening round or the first round of a tournament, you want to have some women in there who can lose, who aren't necessarily going to kind of show up their opponent because the idea is that their opponent is moving on. And they're the one really who you want to promote. They're the one who you want to showcase. So I think it was just a case of them bringing in people maybe that did not have a lot of experience, but who in their mind have a lot of potential. And so, okay, yeah, maybe they're not great right now, but hey, you know, we scouted them and there's something about them, or they're very young and we think there's a lot of potential there. And so let's bring them in and they'll represent this country and they'll lose and they'll, you know, put this other person over, but they're on our radar. So to me, it makes sense, frankly, to do stuff like that. You need women in that tournament to, you know, to lose to. And I don't think it was a case where half the bracket would fall into that category. I think you had mostly really, really, you know, good women who were, you know, handpicked to be in this tournament. I would love to know who the alternates were. I don't know if they ever announced who the backups were. They always have alternates for these things in case somebody gets hurt or there's some sort of emergency and they can't wrestle. But I wouldn't say they deceived us. I mean, I don't really hear people complaining about that. I think overall people were pretty happy, I think, with who they picked. Let's see here. Chris from London, England. Heard a rumor going around that John Cena against The Undertaker could take place at Survivor Series. What are your thoughts, and do you think the match should take place at all? No, I think the finish to WrestleMania this year was the perfect end for The Undertaker's career. But I'm not surprised by the rumor. If you listen to last week's Sound Off, I even said during that first face-off that Cena had with Roman Reigns, the comment that Cena made about Undertaker being a grizzled vet with a bad hip, I said, you know, boy, it sure does look like they're planting maybe a seed for Cena to wrestle The Undertaker at some point. Why would that surprise me when I already floated the idea? In fact, you know, I could picture this being the end of the John Cena-Roman Reigns match at No Mercy. There's been a lot of talk about who wins, who goes over. To me, the answer is Roman Reigns. It's really not that hard, right? Cena's moving on and Roman's moving up and they've got big plans for him yet. And Cena's going to be doing movies and TV stuff and there's no reason for him to go in there and beat Roman Reigns. There's just no reason for it. Unless, you know, they're going to do some kind of a schmoz finish. But whatever the actual finish is, I do think Roman wins. Now, what I could picture happening, though, in the match is it's not a clean win. And because, you know, like I said, Roman's winning. He's my pick. I'll tell you right now. I'm sticking with Roman Reigns. I think he's winning that match. But if The Undertaker is going to come back, okay, and I've seen the same rumors that you have about him. Supposedly he was at SummerSlam training and working out in the ring before the show. Now that doesn't mean he's coming back, but he was there and he was working out and I don't know how he looked. But so could it happen? Yeah, it could happen. It absolutely could happen, and I don't think The Undertaker is done. I've said that before as well. Whether it's just a WrestleMania match or they do something on a Survivor Series with him, I don't think we've seen the last Undertaker match, and I think that's a mistake, but that's just how I feel. But let's say The Undertaker is coming back. Here's the perfect finish. Gong hits, lights go out. This is near, obviously, the end of the match. Gong hits, lights go out. Gong hits again, lights come back on. There's The Undertaker, standing in the middle of the ring between John Cena and Roman Reigns. And he teases going after Roman, because you think he's going to go after Roman, right? Roman beat him at WrestleMania. Roman's been talking smack all these months. I retired The Undertaker. Well, here's The Undertaker, right? To say, I'm not retired yet, bitch. And then he can go after Roman Reigns. Well, what if he swerves everybody? And instead, he grabs John Cena by the throat, gives him a choke slam, which leads to then Roman hitting the spear or whatever, and then winning the match. So it's not a clean win, but it's a win nonetheless. Roman gets his first pay-per-view win, I think it would be since WrestleMania. He's had this horrible streak of just not winning any matches on pay-per-view, which is odd for somebody who, you know, was booked to beat The Undertaker at WrestleMania. It's like, I've said this before, it's like the bizarro version of what they did with Brock Lesnar. When Brock ended the streak in 2014, he went on a... Now, he wasn't wrestling on every pay-per-view like Roman is, but he went on a tear. He was unstoppable, which is exactly how you would want to book somebody if they beat The Undertaker at WrestleMania. You don't want to waste that. But they've done the opposite with Roman, which I just... It doesn't bother me. I just think it's kind of funny. It's kind of weird, right? That he pinned The Undertaker and he hasn't been able to win a pay-per-view match since. So he picks up a win here. And it sets up a John Cena-Undertaker match, if that's the way they want to go. I really think if they do that, they have to save that for WrestleMania. You can't do a match like that at Survivor Series, I don't think. So if they insist on doing it, I would save it for WrestleMania. Let's see here. Josh from Newcastle, England. With the recent departure of JBL from the SmackDown commentary team, do you think WWE should have replaced him with Steve Corino instead of Corey Graves? I am aware that Corino is on the books with WWE as a trainer, but I think he would have done a good job judging from his work with Kevin Kelly in Ring of Honor and New Japan. Brother, I pitch for Corino to double, okay, as a trainer and an announcer on NXT. This was before they brought Nigel in. I think I pitched that idea, and then Nigel came in like a month later, and then the idea was dead. Apparently, from what I understand, he doesn't want to do commentary anymore. It's his call. And Corey Graves is a fine choice. Like I said earlier, he's one of the best they have right now. But a fresh voice is never a bad thing. I would have loved to have seen Corino. I thought Corino did a really good job with Kevin Kelly. I enjoyed them. They were one of my favorite announced teams in all of wrestling when I would watch Ring of Honor. And I would watch their stuff from New Japan when they would get to call some of those shows. I thought the chemistry and the banter between them was a lot of fun. Doesn't want to do it. Can't force the guy. Let's see here. Jad from London, England. My mailbag question concerns Finn Balor. I find myself wondering if he is ever going to get his quote-unquote contractually obligated shot at the Universal title. He was the inaugural champion but had to vacate it the very next night. That makes him a former champion. Every former champion is supposed to have a guaranteed rematch clause in their contract. Well, it's been over a year and Finn still hasn't had his. Well, he could take a number because there has not been a single time where somebody has won and lost the Universal title and gotten a rematch. Nobody. Kevin Owens never did. Goldberg never did. So he can get in line. Anyway, Jad says, personally, I think a match between Finn Balor and Brock Lesnar would pull in plenty of viewers. Given the We Want Balor chants during Paul Heyman's promo the night after WrestleMania, I am clearly not the only one. If Lesnar retains against Braun Strowman at No Mercy, why can't Balor come out and challenge him the next night on Raw? He's already publicly stated he wants the match, but it seems WWE is actively trying to avoid it. What do you think? It would be weird if Brock beat Strowman, this monstered Braun Strowman, and then the very next night the next challenger is Finn Balor. You know, I'm usually not one to say, you know, put much stock in this whole, oh, he's too small. That, I would not give him the next title shot, though. If Braun gets beaten, I would hold off on Balor. I just don't think that just doesn't look right. If Braun can't beat him, what makes you think that Balor can, you know, the very next show? But anyway, I agree. It is ridiculous that the guy got beat, or he never got beat, really, and he comes back and doesn't get a rematch and doesn't even really seem bothered by it either. I mean, he's dropped a comment or two here and there, but you would think, like, Finn Balor needs to be argumentative. He needs to go to Kurt Angle and say, look, Kurt, you know, I came back and I never got beat. I want my title shot. You know, I shouldn't have to qualify for it. When do I get my shot? That's what I would do. Actually, I wouldn't do that because I wouldn't want to wrestle Brock Lesnar. But in theory, he should want to do that. He should want that match in the worst way. And he just doesn't seem concerned at all. And they have him doing whatever the hell he's doing with Bray Wyatt, which I find completely disinteresting. So yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I think what's going on here, and maybe they'll prove me wrong and they'll turn around and book the match for Survivor Series or something, but I think it's pretty obvious what's going on here. They don't want to beat Balor. They don't want to give him the rematch and beat him. which is exactly what would happen if he gets his shot before WrestleMania next year. I am convinced that Brock Lesnar is holding on to this thing, only to drop it to Roman Reigns in New Orleans next year. As much as I would love to see Braun Strowman walk away with the championship, and he'd be a fresh face on top in that role, I don't think it's happening. And so Brock's going to go all the way to Mania next year, and they're going to stick to the plan, and I think Vince McMahon is probably adamant about that. If they do Balor and Lesnar now, October, November, January, Balor loses. Plain and simple. He's not winning that match. So they're, I think what's going on here is they may be trying to protect him in a way. I mean, it's the only logical explanation I can come up with for them avoiding any talk at all of a Balor title shot, because as you said, it doesn't make sense why he would not be going after that shot, why he wouldn't get the shot. And so it stands to reason that they're just protecting him because it's not his time. He's not in the plans. And they have big plans for him. But they don't want to just sort of feed him to the wolves the way they did with Samoa Joe and so many others. Pierre from Montreal. I've been watching the WCW Nitros over again, and I'm up to 1998 right now. My big problem so far is the play-by-play. I think Tony Schiavone is the worst play-by-play guy ever, as he never talks about the matches in the ring. All he ever talks about is the main event. What are your thoughts on Tony, and who do you consider to be the worst play-by-play announcer? You would not be asking me this question right now if you heard Rod Trongard, okay, on play-by-play, at least in his WWF days. Maybe he was good once upon a time. But no, Tony Schiavone was not at all the worst play-by-play guy of all time. In fact, I thought Tony was pretty good. Not the best, but I thought he was closer to the best than the worst. I mean, he talked about the main event all the time. Look, the Monday Night Wars, you know, it was a different time. Like, if you're a newer fan, I guess it's hard to understand what was going on when you had two companies that were pretty much on equal footing at the time, airing at the exact same time. I mean, it really was a battle back and forth between those two companies, and it was a battle for viewers. So they would have each other's shows on in the back, and when one would go to commercial, like WCW would send people, you know, they'd put like their biggest stars out there. They would do stuff like that all the time. And so one of the things that Bischoff had Schiavone and the announcers constantly doing during the Monday Night Wars is talking about what's coming up in the main event. You know what I mean? Like, here's what's going to be going on with our, you know, with our big stars. They wanted to make sure people knew that the big stars were coming up in the main event. Hogan and Sting and the NWO. Everything revolved around the NWO. And, you know, I'm sure by the end, Tony probably just didn't give a shit anymore. So his announcing maybe wasn't that great, let's say, in the year 2000, 2001. But he called the action lots of times. I mean, you know, go listen to him when he worked for WWE. WWE brought him in 1989. I think he was there from 89, maybe until about 90. He was really good. I enjoyed his work with him and Jesse Ventura. You know who else is really good? I'm going to get flamed for this, but it's true. Michael Cole. We just don't get to see it. But I've heard Michael Cole when he's at his best. Go listen to him and Nigel McGuinness calling that UK tournament earlier this year. He was excellent. I'm watching this and I'm thinking to myself, how come we can't have that Michael Cole on Raw every single week? And then I realize why. I realize what the difference was between that Michael Cole and the Michael Cole that we got in the UK tournament. And who was and was not in his ear. But the UK tournament, and here's another great example, the Beast in the East. Remember the Beast in the East special from Japan a couple of years ago? Same thing. Who was in his ear? Who was not in his ear? What do you think the biggest difference was? Go back to the heyday of SmackDown, when Cole was paired off with Taz. I liked the Cole and Taz pairing. I really liked the two of them together. Now, one thing I absolutely can't stand about Michael Cole is the phony enthusiasm in his voice when he's like hyping something up. He comes off as phonier than most. He can't hide it. Some people can do that and pull it off. He can't. He comes off as cheesy, completely unbelievable. Whereas, let's say somebody like Jim Ross back in the 90s when he had to sell you on something, like a big pay-per-view match, or someone did something really heinous, like Triple H did something heinous or Vince McMahon did something really heinous to Steve Austin. He could be over the top with it, absolutely. But you felt his passion. And that's probably my biggest knock, honestly, on Michael Cole. But again, how much of that is him? And how much of that is how he is told to do it? I thought it was an eye-opening thing when that audio leaked online a while back of him on headset answering Vince McMahon in his ear. He was communicating with Vince. It was clearly Vince in his ear. And Cole had a criticism. He was actually talking back to him and had a criticism about something that I already said this a shitload of times. Do I really have to say this again? And then there's like a long pause where you can almost hear Vince probably yelling at him. And then Cole backs off. He's like, oh, okay, yes, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. You can almost hear the deflation in his voice afterwards. You know, like, okay, sir, I'll do it that way, sir. But, I mean, stuff like that UK tournament is what really opened my eyes about how good Cole can be when the handcuffs are off. So I just wanted to say that because the obvious answer to a lot of people, I'm sure, sends up on TV tracks is going to be Michael Cole. Of course, Michael Cole is the worst of all time, but he's really not. He really isn't. I've heard worse. Alan, from the Facebook group, what happened with that Undertaker coma angle around 2010? Because he was never the same after that. I don't recall if it was before or after the WrestleMania 25 match against Shawn Michaels when Undertaker did the suicide dive and landed on his own head, or should I say tombstoned himself, or was it just the years of taking a beating in old age? Well, with the whole coma angle, that was after. Actually, that was after both WrestleMania matches with Shawn, not just the first one. He still had a few good WrestleMania matches left in him. But I agree with you. When he came back after that whole vegetative state nonsense with Kane, you know, Kane was revealed as his attacker. And then they feuded for the 1,000th time. And they brought back Paul Bearer. Undertaker looked awful. He looked just absolutely dreadful. But I think that might have just been by design. I mean, I remember the whole angle was that this guy was laid up in a vegetative state for months. I would imagine it takes a while to get the gears going again after one has been in a vegetative state for so long. But when he first came back, he looked like he aged 1,000 years from the last time we saw him. It was only a matter of, what, I don't know, 5 months, 6 months? In those 6 months, he aged so much. He was slow. I thought I remembered reading that in the time off that he had, he may have had some sort of hip operation. It seems like every other year this guy has some kind of hip surgery. It's amazing he can walk on his own 2 feet. So, but again, I'm not sure if my timetable is right on that or not, but there were definitely rumors he had some kind of a hip procedure. They shaved it down a little bit or something when he was out of action. But I think looking back on it, a lot of that probably was just him playing into the angle. Him struggling to kind of get back up to his feet and all that. But I agree with you. Even beyond him acting like that as part of the angle, he looked just not good. But somehow he came back. WrestleMania 27 and 28, he had those matches with Triple H. And Undertaker's a weird dude, man. I mean, he goes through these phases where you watch him and you look at him. And it's like, well, this is it, right? I mean, he looks terrible. Look at him. He's slow and he's barely mobile. But then, like, a year later, he'll come back and he'll have a pretty good match. You know? Oh, look at him. He looks good. You know? He grew the hair out. He's moving around a little bit better. That's what everybody was saying about him when he had the Bray Wyatt match in San Jose. You know? He was off an entire year. I don't think he even appeared one time in the build-up to that match. It was all videos and vignettes. He came out, and I think part of it was people just were they had very low expectations after that horrible match he had with Brock in New Orleans at WrestleMania 30. And so I think it was going to be hard for him to have a worse match. So I think that was part of it. Maybe people overrated that a little bit because of that. But he definitely looked better than he had the year before that. And then he had the Hell in a Cell match with Shane and, you know, looked like maybe he put on a little bit of weight, but, you know, he had a, you know, the match was okay. And then the match with Roman this year, I thought he didn't look good at all. And again, he was really, it seemed like he was really struggling out there. So, you know, he goes up, he goes down. You never really know what you're going to get with The Undertaker at this point. But yeah, that period in 2010, it was very noticeable that he was moving a lot slower. James from Alexandria, Virginia. We'll end with this. Buy or sell on the dream match that you would rather see? Shawn Michaels against Hiroshi Tanahashi or Bret Hart against Kurt Angle? Oh, I'm buying on Bret and Kurt. This is an easy one, right? Some people are going to say, oh man, that's really hard. Not for me, it's not. Bret Hart and Kurt Angle is like one of my all-time dream matches that I feel cheated out of. Because I have no doubt, you know, were it not for the kick to the head from Goldberg and the stroke, Bret would have been one of these guys who eventually would have come back. I actually think if he was still able to wrestle, he would have been back in WWE years earlier than he was. You got to make that money, right? So he would have been back. And we would have gotten some matches with Bret, like with Kurt Angle and John Cena and people like that. And Randy Orton, right? We would have been able to get matches like that. But the Bret-Kurt match is the one that I think about that sometimes and I'm like, man, we really missed out on a great match there. Not that Michaels and Tanahashi couldn't have had a good match. I don't know what kind of match, honestly, they would have had. Those are two different styles. But they're so good. How could those two go in there and have anything but a great match, right? So that would be great, but I have to buy on Bret Hart against Kurt Angle. That's like my, if I had to make a list, that match would be at the top of my list. If you have questions, like I said earlier, keep sending them on in. TheSolemnMonster@gmail.com is the place to send all of your emails and comments and suggestions and whatnot. You can follow me on Twitter, @SolemnMonster. I'm very active on there with all of my Twitter friends. And then, of course, you can always try to join the Facebook group. We've got a lot of people waiting in queue. But if you are not a bot, if you are an active member of the Sound Off community and want to be part of the group and you've been waiting for a while, best thing to do is to shoot me a message on Facebook and let me know and then reapply. Because the queue now is so long, there's some people I'm never going to get to. It's to the point where not only are there so many like thousands of people in there, and some of them I know are just like bots and spam accounts, which is why I'm so selective in who I let in. But there, you know, if there's 7,000 plus in queue, which is what we have right now, I don't doubt the majority of that is probably legitimate. But I like to vet before I let people in. So if you have been waiting, by all means, cancel and reapply and then shoot me a message and let me know. We'll try to get you in there. We'll be back with a brand new podcast next weekend. That'll be episode 513. Again, to all the people still suffering down in the Houston and Louisiana areas, hopefully the money that we were able to give is of some small help. And we'll see what happens with Irma. Because as I'm recording this, it's first slamming into Florida. It's probably going to get worse over the next 24 hours. So if you are a fan of the show, if you're listening to this right now, if you are from the area, I'm pulling for you. I really hope that it's minimal damage and you're safe and everything works out to not be as bad as they say it's going to be. But it's not looking too good. And then again, you've got Jose bringing it up the rear here. It's just never ending cycle. Best wishes to everybody who is hunkering down and dealing with that. Hopefully, you're out of harm's way and all is well. And we will see you back here for a brand new podcast next weekend. So until then, take care, be well, stay safe, and we'll see you back for 513.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemnmonster sounds off.
Mundo goes to leave, and Taya says, wait, aren't you going to put any pants on? He just goes, no time for pants, and he walks off. That also happens to be Randy Orton's philosophy in life. My philosophy, too. You see, you don't know if I'm wearing pants right now or not, do you? You can't see. I could be wearing nothing right now for all you know. No time for pants.
Solemnmonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solemnmonster sounds off. Available at thesolemnmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemnmonster sound off.